We start this week by looking at 7-7, and I'm going to hand over to Angela Balassi, who's going to be grilling me about it.
Yes, I'll be speaking to Tony, who worked on the IRA bombing campaign in the early 1990s for the BBC. Tony, firstly, what was that like?
Well, certainly, yes. It was for the BBC, not for the IRA. I was working on it. But it was, I suppose, fascinating, really, to be working in a busy newsroom in central London and to see the contrast between the way that different types of news stories got dealt with in our newsroom. So there was everything from a corporate press release, say a big company who's announcing something that day with a press conference, or even sending a spokesperson into the studios to say something which had really been pre-prepared by public relations team, to the really the bombing campaign was on the opposite end of the spectrum. So it was really completely unexpected, and a lot of resources in the newsroom had to be devoted to covering it. We had a because I was working at Greater London Radio in Marylebone High Street, all the BBC's local stations, and we were the local station for the whole of London, had this thing called what we used to call the voice of God in the ceiling. The first we knew about the bombings, for example, the Stock Exchange bomb that happened, I think it was 1990, a voice would come out of the ceiling, which was from the BBC's Broadcasting House Central newsroom, telling us that these sorts of things had happened. And so then what would happen is the news editor, James Cameron it was at the time, would assign reporters either sending some by motorbike sometimes, or by car, and also by tube, so that we get a range of different people to get to the scene first.
And can you draw any comparisons with the IRA bombings to that of 7-7?
Well, I felt, as someone who worked on these bombings in London, that the way it was reported was very different. We weren't getting a consistent story. Right from the word go, there were conflicting accounts, which I would suggest, you know, there has to be something behind that. I mean, the most important one was the very day of 7-7. We were told, for example, that Benjamin Netanyahu, who's now the Israeli Prime Minister, he was then the Finance Minister of Israel, was in London, and that everyone was very concerned because they knew that he was due to be at Liverpool Street at the same time as the Liverpool Street bomb went off. So quite rightly, the news wires in Israel particularly were phoning up the embassy in London saying, how is BB okay? Well, it turned out that, and this was reported at the time, that he got a warning not to leave his hotel that day, which is rather surprising, because it was supposed to be a surprise attack with the bombs all going off pretty much simultaneously at 9:30. Then there were conflicting accounts of what had happened. Some said he left the hotel and then he'd come back. Others said he never left the hotel. And so there were instantly conflicting accounts of events, which we never really got any of that in the IRA bombing campaign, certainly as far as I can remember. You know, one of the things, for example, with the Baltic Wharf bomb the IRA planted was really troubling, but that was actually coming out as part of the coverage. The troubling thing was that it looked as if the IRA cell had been under surveillance for weeks, and still MI5 allowed them to plant that bomb.
And why do you think that was?
I think it's difficult to know, but you know, you have to use guesswork, because the authorities won't tell you anything about the security services. I think probably it was because they need to justify their job, they need to justify their position, and if there ain't any bombs going off, then there's no need for an MI5.
Even at the expense of people's lives?
Well, in that case, there was only one person killed, because there was a warning, although there were lots and lots of windows shattered in Canary Wharf, Baltic Wharf. Only one person was killed, and that was, I think it was a Daily Express photographer who disobeyed police orders to come back, and he went right up to where the truck bomb was just taking a photograph when it exploded.
Okay, and going back to the 7-7, there have also been films made about this which haven't been shown. Why do you think that is?
Well, they haven't been shown on mainstream television, as far as I know, anywhere in the world, which is really surprising, because some of them are very good. Well, there's one called BT, and I've no idea why it's called that. I think it's just because this was the anonymous name of the person on the internet that made it. And this came out in about seven different versions in the 3 or 4 weeks after the 7-7 bombings. And what this person had done, they just put together various bits of footage from news broadcasts and radio broadcasts mainly, also quotes from newspapers, which proved in many cases that what we were being told about the London bombings was just simply inconsistent. So, for example, they point out that Mark Honingsbaum, who was the Guardian's reporter, the very first report he did, lunchtime on the day of the London bombings, he was saying, and you can hear him on this documentary saying, Mark Honingsbaum, that the bombs were underneath the trains after having spoken to the people as they were coming out from the Edgware Road tube bombing. Also, other anomalies were that there's a chap called Daniel Obachiki who says he was on the bus, and he said that this guy, Hasib Hussein, who was supposed to be the bus bomber, simply wasn't on the bus. And he said there was a very suspicious guy who was acting suspiciously, who he said was saying left his rucksack upstairs on the bus, and this guy hopped off just before the bus exploded. He said he thought he was the bomber, and yet Daniel's story has really not been heard.
Why do you think that is?
Because I think sometimes the news media don't like to be labelled conspiracy theorists. They would much rather go along with the government narrative if the government and the police say this is what happened. Why should they question it? And I think this is a real problem with our modern media, is they don't actually question enough. But really the best, I think, of those various different documentaries which were made about 7/7 was called Ludicrous Diversion, and that refers to Tony Blair's statement saying that a public inquiry into the bombings would be a ludicrous diversion. Blair was saying we know what happened, so why would we have a public inquiry? He was ignoring a fact, of course, that this is what all of the victims' families, people who are injured in the blasts, were calling for. Ludicrous Diversion is a pretty good examination of some of the things that the government and the police have told us happened that day that simply don't add up.
And there were 52 people who were killed and 770 who were injured. Do you think the victims, their families, have been heard?
Well, they have, but only just. And in fact, even more recently, it came out that some of the victims' families had had their phone hacked by the News of the World, which is really an appalling thing to do for someone who's lost their kids. They then find that not only that, but the Murdoch Press is trying to steal information from them, hack their phones. It really just adds insult to injury. But the main problem has been that many of the main questions that the families have asked, that is to say, the security services said that the four bombers were clean skins. They said they had no record of them, and it's later transpired in court cases, in trials, that actually they had very big files on at least three of the four bombers. The families want to know why nothing was done, even though the security services had been following these people around all over the world, some of them, and keeping a very, very close eye on them. So why was the surveillance not completed? Also, the families were not allowed to ask questions at the inquest. There was an inquest into those 52 deaths, which is a strange thing to do. Actually, it should have been a public inquiry if there's a large number of people dying, but an inquest is designed really just for one individual death. And so the families are really not satisfied with that, and to this day they're still calling not for a public inquiry anymore, but an independent inquiry like the Hillsborough inquiry, because they still don't feel that their questions have been answered. And this is just a quote, one of the family members feels stonewalled by the government.
And this stonewalling, who does this benefit?
Well, difficult to know, but it seems that there are people. I mean, I think he lost his 22-year-old son in the bombings. One of the things he said is that they have clear evidence that that people in the security services knew about these guys and had them under surveillance in the weeks running up, and yet nothing has changed. So the systems that led to the London bombings taking place are still in place. What that suggests is that something else, exactly the same, could happen again, and the same mistakes be made all over again. And I think they're absolutely right to be calling for a proper independent inquiry along the lines of Hillsborough, which effectively means it be led by the families rather than by the government.
So I suppose arguably somebody could be under surveillance, but that doesn't mean it will amount to anything.
Well, I think they want to know where the security services have fallen down. I mean, just to go back to the Lee Rigby killing 2 years ago in Woolwich, for example, the security services actually had the two killers sprung from jail in Africa and brought to Britain, and then they carried out this attack. So you do have to wonder what the security services are up to, because what the main problem here is people who have been responsible for these acts which have led to terror attacks and innocent people dying here in Britain have never been called to account.
What lessons do you think can be learned from 7/7?
I think mainly don't allow privatisation of the tube. This is another aspect to it all, is that contracts were let out just about 5 months, I think, before the London bombings. And there are suspicions about the companies that had access to the tube tunnels beforehand. So most people travelling on the London Underground don't realise that parts of it have been privatised.
So do you think somebody's benefiting financially, potentially, from...
Well, the main benefit seems to me to be to the, first of all, to those that want to take away civil liberties here in Britain, and also those that want to pursue wars abroad.
Okay, thank you, Tony.
Thanks, Angela.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Okay.